Hi everybody out there, this is Kai.
And Michael.
From Unisonic.
Exactly.
And you're listening to the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast.
Hi, I'm Fast Eddie Clark and you're listening to the Classic Rock Metal Podfest cast. I'll do that again. Hi, I'm Fast Eddie Clark and you're listening to the Classic Rock... Hi, I'm Fast Eddie Clark and you're listening to the Classic Rock Metal Podcast. Did that one do? Sorry, mate.
This is the Classic Rock and Metal Podcast, featuring all your favorite bands from the 70s and 80s. The old stuff, the news, interviews, everything you need for your hard rock and metal fix, right here, right now.
All right, I know what we said last time, but really, honestly, we're back for good now. You'll be able to set your watch by us. First Monday of the month, you'll get your fix. In fact, we've got some in-between shows planned, so there'll be more classic rock and metal than you can shake a stick at. Probably. This is, of course, the regular monthly podcast format that you know and love, but we hope that subscribers enjoyed the first in our Classic Rock and Metal Archive series earlier this month, which featured a 1985 interview with ZZ Top. If you haven't heard it yet, you can find it on iTunes, of course, or just head for classicrockpodcast.com. Anyway, on with the show, and better late than never. We're extremely honoured to have spoken to one of the most respected musicians in prog rock, certainly, but contemporary music in general, Jethro Tull's Ian Anderson, who speaks fondly of those who interrupt the more sedate sections of his live show with calls for Aqualung and the like.
I mean, they should be hung up, drawn and quartered. No, not before they've had their testicles forcibly removed.
A member of Motorhead's classic lineup, Fast Eddie Clark, proves he still has the chops by resurrecting Fastway, releasing a stonking new record and letting us in on the secret of recording an album in double quick time.
But I mean, we used to do an album in a couple of weeks, really, two or three weeks, but we were done, you know, because we couldn't get out of there fast enough to get to the pub.
Unisonic is the new vehicle from two of 80s rock's royal family, Kai Hansen and Mikael Kiske, formerly, of course, with Helloween. Their new album is one of the year's finest so far, and amongst other things, I asked them what they missed about the old days.
Well, I still miss spandex trousers, bullet belts.
You can still get them, though.
Yeah, sure.
And finally, rock royalty doesn't come much bigger than UFO, but long-serving keyboard and guitarist Paul Raymond is still humble after all these years.
Ooh, how's it feel to be a rock legend, Oliver?
That's the one, yeah.
I think if you stay in the business long enough, you know, they're going to start saying that to you. I always go, I'm not Jimmy Page or Pete Townsend, doing me a favour.
Rock legends don't come any bigger or well-loved than John Lord, Deep Purple's long-standing keyboard player who sadly lost his battle with cancer recently. Let's kick off then with a song from 1984's Perfect Strangers album, which features a trademark musical exchange between him and guitarist Ritchie Blackmore. This is Gypsy's Kiss.
One time.
So yes, John Lord passed away last month at 71 after he seemed to be winning his battle with pancreatic cancer, but sadly it was not to be. And there was an astonishing outpouring of appreciation for someone who was clearly respected by not just a huge cross-section of the music community, but from all walks of life. Twisted Sister and Guns N' Roses, Bryan Adams, Bob Harris, Whitesnake, Sabbath, Ewan McGregor. The list is almost endless of tributes you can read on the web, and rightly so, he will be sadly missed. Another great loss was that of Ronnie Montrose, who sadly committed suicide after apparently years of being tormented with feelings of inadequacy from childhood. He left a very sad note, which you can read in this month's show notes. Now, in recent months, there have been some departures of very high-profile band members. Mike Portnoy from Dream Theater, KK Downing from Priest, of course, Bill Ward from the recently reformed Black Sabbath, and last month, Jeff Tate got his marching orders from Queensryche after 30 years, who've now already begun touring and recording with new singer Todd LaTorre, who you may remember from Crimson Glory, who he's also still with. There's been a slew of public statements and legal machinations and reports that Tate and members of the band came to blows before what were to be the last shows with him on vocal duties. They'll be back in court in November, haggling over use of the name and other issues, no doubt. On the subject of who gets the name, Adrian Vandenberg, who, even to an outsider, quite clearly founded the band Vandenberg, has slammed his former bandmates who are trying to prohibit him from using the name. It's apparently the second time they've tried to do it. Presumably, they haven't worked out that they could just use one of their own surnames and avoid the problem. There was a historic moment last month when Aerosmith was joined on stage by Run DMC's Daryl DMC McDaniels in New Jersey for a performance of Walk This Way. You'll recall it was back in 86 that the collaboration between the two bands on that song helped kickstart Aerosmith's career and kind of ushered in a much bigger awareness for rock and metal music's affinity with rap. Incidentally, after a couple of years of sulking in opposing corners, Joe Perry and the band seem to have patched up their differences with vocalist Steven Tyler, who you may recall went off to whore himself on the American Idol show in the US, and they have a new album due out at the end of the year. Motley Crue drummer Tommy Lee split opinion this month by heading online to slam fans for constantly wanting their picture taken with him. This apparently was provoked when he was picking up his mother's ashes to take them home and was accosted by someone who clearly had no concept of there being a time and a place. Black Sabbath headlined Donington in June to great applause, although of course it was Sabbath without Bill Ward, and of course it's Download not Donington, so it's a kind of reformed band bolstering ticket sales for a kind of rock and metal festival, depending on how you look at it. Still, a good time seemed to be had by all, so what the heck. And still in Sabbath land, Tony Iommi has responded well to treatment for cancer and of course played the Download show in June with Sabbath, plus the headlining spot at the Lollapalooza festival in the US this month. Now, Jethro Tull have been prog and folk rock legends since 1967, and I could spend an entire hour detailing their achievements and huge influence on the music scene over the years, but it was vocalist and original member Ian Anderson's decision to release a follow-up to the band's 1972 concept album Thick as a Brick and play both albums live on a new world tour that got me on the phone for a natter. The first and most obvious question was, after 40 years, why now?
It wasn't a very satisfactory experience back in 1972. When we got to the USA, it was very difficult because Jethro Tull had a visibility, if that's the right term, on what was then called AOR radio, you know, being pretty much a rock band. And the tracks that were getting the heaviest rotation were the more rock songs from the Aqualung album, songs like Cross-Eyed Mary and Aqualung and Locomotive Breath, things that, although they may have had, in some cases, some quieter or acoustic sections, it was the loud, noisy flute, electric guitar bits that, you know, the more rock type fans seem to fasten onto and remember. So it was difficult to do Thick as a Brick, which obviously did require a little patience on the part of the audience, because there were a lot of sections of music that were acoustic for quite a long time during the songs. I found it particularly difficult because in the wake of Aqualung and the Benefit album, there were always these rather noisy fans who would shout and scream and holler and hoot and, you know, shout, rock and roll, play Aqualung. You know, when you were trying to play something that was actually quite difficult to play and on which you had to really focus your attention as a performer. I say fans. I mean, they're not. They're just louts. You know, they could have been throwing stones in Athens, you know, or petrol bombs at policemen, you know. Yeah. There's some people out there who just like to be, they like to disturb, they like to be antisocial. They like to bully people on the internet. They like to invade chat rooms as so-called trolls. I mean, they should be hung up, drawn, and quartered. No, not before they've had their testicles forcibly removed. These days, particularly when I do as I do, most of my concerts is Ian Anderson, it doesn't really happen. Mm. Even in America, it doesn't really happen. It's different now. Therefore, I thought I could give it another go. Mm. But I wouldn't be giving it another go in terms of the 72 Thick as a Brick if I didn't have something else new to offer. So although we didn't announce it as such before we had recorded the album, for obvious reasons, I thought that it was a good idea to record a sequel to Thick as a Brick. We had a lot of, good musicians having fun doing it. And, you know, we left a little bit to the studio process so that it wasn't all cut and dried. And Topped and Tailed as arrangements, a little bit left to that creative process in the studio, just of some new ideas and little changes to the arrangement, fine-tuning, and things that just kept it bubbling and kept everybody on their toes. So it was a good experience, and happily it worked out well, and I'm then in the position, as you can appreciate now, to actually announce that there is a new album, Thick as a Brick 2, or Tab 2 as I call it, so we'll be playing both Thick as a Brick 1 and 2 live on stage in the concerts this year. Something brave and stupid to do. As you get too old to have all your marbles about you, you can make some profound and quite idiotic decisions, so I'm perfectly prepared for this to be greeted with hoots of derision or even just stony silence. But I'm doing it for me. You know, in sex, I'm a very generous person. I exist you know, to make my wife happy. But in matters of music, I am totally selfish.
There's some nerves in there, or really quite happy for the audience that's been with you for so long to support you regardless? I mean, how do you feel about doing them together?
Well, the new one's not such a problem because, number one, it's fresher in the mind. Number two, there is only one ill-advised moment when enthusiasm got the better of me, where I sang and played a flute note at the same time. After the mixing had already started, I suddenly decided to add a little bit of flute in a couple of lines, and went back and did it as an overdub, and just didn't stop to think I was, you know, the last note of a run of flute coincided with the first note of vocal. So that's the only place that I can't recreate. Everything else is very playable because it was written and designed to be played, and we try to keep it very much without loads of overdubs and to keep a very live feel to the recording so that we could recreate that on stage. When I've been out and about in Latin America during last year on tour, I was amazed how much the audience had changed in just 5 years since I'd been there previously. That it was a huge skew to a much younger audience. And I should be grateful for that, but by the same token, it was a real surprise, you know, playing the same venues and see completely different people. Same venues, same time of the year, just 5 years later. It was chalk and cheese in terms of audience demographics. So things do change, and I think you've got to be prepared to accept what's out there at the time and try to make sure that you can put tickets on sale and somebody's going to buy them. But, of course, we are in a recession. People are making careful choices about what they spend their money on, and we'll often be driven by, you know, ticket prices, which is why bands like Porcupine Tree or The Darkness, for example, go out at, I mean, very, very startlingly low ticket prices in order to do good business. However, their margins must be eroded to nothing, or indeed less than nothing. In other words, very easy to run at a loss on tour if you're trying to sell a £20 ticket, let alone a $20 ticket. So it's a difficult time for everybody. And again, it tends to be the younger emerging artists who will find it hardest of all because, you know, to get out there and do your first tour, to go to America and be faced with, you know, £2,000 or £3,000 per person for a visa cost. It's just you know, the overheads are just astronomical now.
Your son-in-law Andrew Lincoln plays the lead character in the hugely popular TV show The Walking Dead. Are you comfortable being related to currently the world's most famous zombie slayer? I mean, there's heavy metal bands who'd kill for that kind of kudos.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's I mean, we were sitting talking about that last night. That, you know, it's great, you know, to be, especially if you're the lead actor in a hugely successful, and it's hugely successful worldwide, which
Absolutely.
Is an amazing thing. I mean,
it's a huge thing.
It's not just in the USA or to an extent in the UK. I mean, it's 130 countries or something. It's been sold into now, and it's it's a huge thing. I mean, Andy's actually off at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning to jump on a plane and go to America for days of promo, including David Letterman and so on, which he's not comfortable with. He doesn't like sitting on the couch on breakfast TV or whatever it is. It's what he finds it really, really hard, and he's very nervous about it. But he knows he's got to do it. It's part of being a team player. You have to do press and promo, and he tends to have to do not all of it, but most of it, as being the key guy.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot on his shoulders, and it goes on this year, and by all accounts, I mean, we'll probably go to a fourth season as well. But, right. You know, 6 months away from home, 6 months away from, taking his family with him, it's a tough ride. But some people will do anything, you know, to blow the heads off zombies. And Andy, in spite of his more thespian leanings and RADA training, actually really enjoys the challenge of the role, which is more than just. The zombies are incidental. They're a vehicle.
Exactly.
They are there in order to give a completely implausible scenario, which we never really understand the reason for. We don't really know how this has happened or why it's happened or where it's headed. Really what it's about is a lot of little morality tales of people having to work together and explore their assets, their failings, their foibles, and work things out. And so, you know, it's a series of little life lessons. The Walking Dead is a much more intelligent production than perhaps would be obvious to people just hearing about it. And a lot of people are turned off even watching it, even Andrew Lincoln fans, simply because they don't really get into the zombie thriller killer kind of ethos. But there's a lot more to it than that. And the zombies, whilst they make a fairly regular presence, they certainly are not the main event in the series, so much as the actual storytelling and the characters themselves. So it's a good series, and without plugging it overduly, it starts again this coming Friday in the UK. So I, for one, will be setting my video recorder to ready, since I'm rarely around to watch it at the time that it plays live.
Really don't mind if you sit this one out. My words but a whisper, your deafness a shout. I may make you feel that I can't make you think. Your sperm's in the gutter, your love's in the sink. So your ride sails over the fields, and you make all your animal deals, and your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a brick. Sandcastle virtues are all swept away in the tidal destruction, the moral melee. The elastic retreat rings the close of play as the last wave uncovers the newfangled way. But your new shoes are worn at the heels, and your suntan was rapidly peeled, and your wise men don't know how it feels to be thick as a brick.
Unisonic is a band featuring guitarist Kai Hansen and vocalist Michael Kiske, both former members of German 80s power metalers Halloween, so you'd be excused for thinking you already knew what their new record was going to sound like. However, you might be surprised to discover a very melodic, accessible album, the first collaboration between the two since Halloween's iconic Keeper of the Seven Keys back in 1987. I asked if their reputation preceding them with regard to this new project had been a problem.
When people hear we're together, certain expectations are raised, and we never thought about fulfilling any expectations. We just did what was there. And yep. and that was, in the end, if you look back, it's a mix of all our abilities and influences and so on. And that has a chemistry of its own. It's beyond Gamma Ray or Halloween or whatever anybody of us did.
That makes us band. I think this makes a band in general.
And that's really cool to have an own identity and an own face. That's the best we can actually get.
It's strange because when people would they hear about the partnership and they might get an expectation of sort of a Halloween
might be.
European.
You don't know what the next record would have been.
Well, yeah, maybe. But they might think it's going to be power metal or very heavy metal or more Avantasia type of style of thing. But obviously a lot of our listeners are English. And what I got from the very first track, Unisonic, was I got the first riff was kind of like a late 70s, early 80s riff. It was like almost like a British, and I was like, what is this? And then as the song goes on, it actually gets kind of more modern sounding as it goes through, but it doesn't sound strange. So I just think, and the whole record, I just think people are going to love it, especially people that like the old style.
Yeah.
But it doesn't sound old.
No. That's what everybody says, right?
Yeah,
it, it reminds them of us, of course. I mean, we can reject what we sound like. I mean, when I sing a song that he has written, it will always have a certain sound, but that it sounds fresh, and that's great to hear.
Because I think all us in the band, we have grown up or thrived on 70s rock. And 80s,
especially British 80s music.
Metal or new wave of British heavy metal. All that.
Maiden, I mean, it was like the gods.
And it's all in there.
Yeah.
Plus, of course, we kind of, for some reason, we managed to get a modern approach, not being stuck only repeating old things and old times. But something about the album was getting into a modern direction, and that's cool.
You know what I think that is? If you're excited about what you're doing, I think that is the whole secret.
Maybe.
If you're excited about it, you add something to it that's not from yesterday, because it's present excitement.
I mean, the landscape has changed a lot since you guys first broke through.
Definitely.
The industry, and also internet. The musical style, the internet. I mean, is there anything that you miss badly from the 80s, and anything you really don't miss?
Nothing yet. I think it feels pretty much the same.
Well, I still miss spandex trousers, bullet belts.
You can still get them, though.
Yeah, sure.
And I miss the hair.
There's a lot of people that still, you know, do a revival of those things. Even young kids or, you know, the old farts that still can't stop to do this again and again. So, actually, there's nothing really to be missed. What I miss, you know, talking about metal, not the music scene itself, just metal, is like part of that easiness that was there in the beginning when everything was metal. Now everything is so put in little drawers, and the drawers getting smaller and smaller with much more stuff cramped in. So it's like funk jazz fusion thing.
Progressive.
Drawer, and then it's like the death blood hell Satan. Evil sounds of metal, and then there's the death evil blood song, which makes a bit difference actually.
And rock, metal. Progressive, rock, know? Melodic,
so
rock,
already,
power,
already,
speed, metal.
I always hated this thing between, it's like heavy metal and power metal. It's
what's
like, you know, actually people always came up with these things, especially in southern countries. They go, power metal, power metal. And say, what the fuck is power metal?
Yeah.
Isn't that heavy metal? It's not power metal. And so define power metal. Double bass drum.
Where does rock start? Where does metal end? I mean, there is no definition for that.
Well, it's funny because obviously the show that we have, there isn't a definition, because we could be listening to Creedence Clearwater, we could be listening to Deep Purple, we could be listening to Venom.
Could have been the metal LP.
It's just what we used to call heavy metal.
Exactly.
I mean, all right, there was thrash and maybe black metal, but they were very different. But now, I mean, we never had that. We didn't have to worry about it.
Born to be Wild, that's actually, I think, where the term heavy metal was born.
Exactly.
The heavy metal thunder
heavy
thing.
Metal thunder.
And if you listen to the music, actually, it is heavy metal. You know, it's like,
Just the earlier you the
it sounds
more,
a bit
further
different
you go, the more it's based on rock and roll. That's
great,
and the production is different. Yeah.
But anyhow, you know, it's like seeing. It's always from the perspective of the viewer. What is what? And as Michael put it before, says somebody who listens to pop would think Bon Jovi is heavy metal.
Exactly.
Somebody who listens to Slayer would say Unisonic is a pop band.
It's just a personal thing where I have heard so many different things on the same song or record or whatever opinions. I can't take any of it serious anymore. I leave it fine, whatever makes you happy, you know.
Yeah, call it whatever you want.
Everybody has his own definition.
And how did you guys get back together for this project?
We never really got separate. I mean, we were not hanging out every day or something, but he was part of my first solo record. I was singing on the first Gamma Ray and then the last one. We always had... We were always in touch.
We were loosely connected somehow, didn't lose that. And we got back together by, you know, him actually stopping to hang out in his...
Reading room
and playing PlayStation, wanting to have a band really and going active on the scene. And when I heard that, I felt very happy for him, because I always thought it was a waste of talent. And then finally it happened that we went on the Avantasia tour together, and there we got so much response by the audience, and we felt that, wow, this is, you know, when I play the guitar and he sings to it, it kind of, it's got something very, very special. And we should do something with it. And finally, you know, we went through the options with, you know, Project or him to Gamma Ray or me to Unisonic. And finally, me to Unisonic was the best option. And we checked that out. And everything fell into place. Everything felt great. And it was just now or never.
Right.
Exactly. I'm 44 now. That's still okay. Yeah. But if I wait another 10 years...
Would have been... Probably. Or something. Anyhow, it just felt right doing this now.
Well, also, I mean, Gamma Ray, I guess, because you'll be playing some shows this year, I guess, and so Gamma Ray will take a back seat. Does it help when you've had a long-term project to do something else and then come back to it?
Refreshing, yeah. Absolutely. I'm kind of, you know, they put a lot of heart and effort in this thing here, but it did it really with a lot of passion. And, of course... Getting this out and feeling this, when I return to work with Gamma Ray again, it will have an impact on the positive side as well.
Also refreshing in that direction.
Yeah, because I start something new again.
It's like having holidays.
Instead of being like in the same routine kind of thing every time. Sometimes it's really, really cool. It's like, you know, going on holidays, experiencing great things, and then going home again. You see your home in a different angle.
Being in the UK, we talk occasionally about the Castle Donington Monsters of Rock Festival, which was the mecca. It was the only show in town for us every year. 88 was the one that you, well, certainly the one you played and became infamous because it was a great bill, but also because a couple of guys died during the Guns N' Roses set. What were your memories of that day?
I thought it was really cool, especially backstage.
Yeah, it was great. It was just like woohoo. Everybody was suddenly there. I mean, you know, we were kind of kids. That were jumping from being just a fan to in a short time jumping to a level being playing on the biggest festival ever with, you know, the big guys and so on. And we were like, woo.
And the backstage scenery was different then. It was not so isolated as it is now.
No, absolutely.
It's very open. You could just walk and talk to everyone. Mm. I like that a lot better than this superstar crap.
And did you, because I think you were on opening slot, and I think, and then Guns N' Roses were third from, were you still there when, because the crowd was gradually getting more and more restless as the day went on.
The whole day.
Yeah. And I think, we didn't find out till afterwards. I mean, it was only when I got home that I knew at the time because I was in the crowd. It was really mad.
While we were there.
I thought one problem started when David Lee Roth was on. I know that one from the audience went up. I still remember that. And said something, he used to just get off my fucking head. I didn't know what was going on, you know. But there was already something going on down there.
Here we go then with the title track from that new album. This is Unisonic. Yeah. Fast Eddie Clark was a member of Motorhead's classic lineup, playing on their debut album, Overkill, Bomber, No Sleep Till Hammersmith, and of course Ace of Spades, before leaving in 1982 and forming Fastway with Pete Way, who had recently left UFO. They had some success in the 80s, but since then there's been little output until last year, when a call came from an old friend who suggested he dust off that famous old Marshall.
A guy called Steve Strange, he's an agent. He's actually Coldplay's agent. And so he said, oh, I can get you some shows, you know. And I said, well, all right then, because he plays drums and we used to play together a bit. So he said, look, man, I'll play the drums, you know, and I'll sort everything out. And he said, do you want to meet Toby Jepson? And I said, yeah, of course, you know, anybody you think that could do the job. And he brought Toby down to one of the rehearsals and we got on straight away. Toby's a true profesh, you know, he doesn't muck about. And well, we hit it off straight away. So we did those shows together. And then, of course, it petered out after that. But, you know, we did manage to get back together again and do this record about 3 years later. So everything seems to take so long these days.
You haven't got some awful label cracking the whip and telling you to get it done in a week, have you?
But that's right. No, that used to be murder. I was telling someone about that the other day, that, you know, in the motorway days, or even the early Fastway days, you know, you'd get off the road after being on the... You make an album, you go on the road for 9 months, then they want another record. So they can release it in, you know, in the 12 months, you know. And it was bloody murder. Of course, that's why a lot of the tracks, I mean, a couple of the albums I can think of in particular was Iron Fist was one that we were really stamped on over that, because they wanted it, you know, the record company needed the revenue, and one thing or another, it was Bronze Records. And of course, when you make records under that sort of duress, they don't really work out that well. And All Fired Up was another similar situation where, you know, the record company were crying out for a record, and because they were skint, they just wanted another record. And the producer didn't want to spend too much time in England, and oh, you know, one thing or another. And of course, when you make records under those sort of circumstances, the record suffers, you know.
I must have been murder to make them, but of course, a lot of those classic albums, you know, Motorhead and a lot of the new wave British heavy metal albums were made exactly under those circumstances, and some would say that's part of the charm.
Well, that's right. Well, Motorhead, I mean, we used to do an album in a couple of weeks, really, 2 or 3 weeks. We were done, you know, because we couldn't get out of there fast enough to get to the pub. But you know, it's in those different circumstances. But even, you know, in the early days of a band, you're hot to trot. You know, you've got lots of ideas. You're bubbling with enthusiasm. So the first few albums are normally okay. 2 or 3, I'd say, are normally, you know, come out pretty easily. It's after that that it becomes a bit of a struggle. You know, it's really after that. I mean, in the case of the Fastway thing, it was the second album, but it really wasn't, because we were all old soldiers by then, apart from the singer, you know. So there wasn't that bubbling under stuff. You know, we had been on the road a long time with Fastway. We're literally on the road a year, you know. It's just you need a bit of time just to take a breath and come up with some new ideas, you know. But Motorhead, we had all the ideas right up until Ace of Spades. We just had all the ideas. It was quite fantastic, really.
Going back to the new album, I got it just that trademark sound. It was kind of strange to hear it coming through the speakers on a new track after so long. It was really nice to hear. You're probably still using the same gear, are you?
Exactly the same. Yeah, I've got the same guitars. I've still got my Motorhead Stratocaster, and I've got my what I call my Fastway Les Paul. And I've still got the amp I used with Fastway. I discovered it at a rehearsal in 1983 at John Henry's, and I played through it, and it just had that little bit of extra certain something. And I said to John Henry, I said, John, I've got to have this amp. And he said, that's all right, man, you know, you could give me X amount of money for it, and a little bit over the odds, you know, which was brilliant, because he's a lovely bloke. And I've kept it with me ever since. It goes everywhere I go, you know, it never, so... So I've kind of kept exactly the same sound. I even use the same pedals, you know. So I noticed that myself, that, you know, this is just me doing what I do, you know, rather than trying to be something I'm not, you know.
I wanted to talk about the name of the band, because it only just occurred to me the other day. I mean, obviously it's Fastway, but originally it was because it was you and Pete Way. It wasn't obviously of UFO. Didn't he do a bunk before the first album was recorded? Do I remember that right?
He did, yeah. No, he did. He disappeared. We had a few, yeah, because it was, you know, we were sitting there trying to come up with a name for the band, and of course it was Naff, you know. We said, well, you know, we were hailed as the new heavy metal supergroup then, you know. We were laughing about it. We said, well, I'm Fast Eddie, you're Pete Way, why don't we call it Fastway? And we all laughed, you know. We were at the pub pissed, you know. And well, we couldn't come up with anything else after that. It's one of those, you know, things stick. So we thought, well, we can get over the embarrassment of calling it Fastway, you know. People saying, oh, that's a bit fucking obvious, isn't it, you know. So we called it Fastway, and then of course Pete disappeared. We had a few problems with Chrysalis. Chrysalis were not a very nice outfit, I have to say. They treated Pete very badly, and they wanted to ruin his life, and they kind of succeeded, really, because I think Fastway was good for him. But they wouldn't release him to do the Fastway stuff, and of course, obviously, I was quite prepared to go through the legal channels and get it sorted out. But of course, then Pete had an offer from Sharon Osbourne to join Ozzy Osbourne. Which I think Pete probably thought, because I didn't see Pete for 7 years after that. He just disappeared, and he never said a f***ing word to me. He was gone. Didn't even call me. I didn't even get a message through anyone.
Jesus.
It was quite amazing. And but actually, I was very upset, obviously, you can imagine, because it was our baby, you know. And that's really why I think once he had left, really, the heart for me had gone out of it, you know, because it was fast way, you know. But these things, you know, you tend to stumble on because... At that point, you know, it was all I had in the fire. You know, I had nothing going for me. I didn't have any money or anything because Motörhead, you know, I got completely done over on the Motörhead thing. So I was skint, so I had to keep working, and it was the only job in town, you know.
This is a show for people with long memories, and if people go back to the 80s, they remember that there was a time when rock and metal was very popular with Hollywood in terms of getting the music into the films. And there was I remember a tremendous film called Trick or Treat, which people will now start remembering because it had various people in it. But that really did for you, didn't it? Because that soundtrack was in the Billboard chart for ages, wasn't it?
It was, and I mean, Music Week in England, one of their top 10 best albums of the year. And writing the songs was good because, you know, you speak to the director, he says, well, I want one that sounds a bit like this, you know, and you go, all right, and then you sort of work it out and think, well, we need to write one like this, guys, you know. And it was interesting, but Dave by then had had enough of, as he said, well, he said he'd had enough of every rock by then. So it was the last thing he did. That was the end of my career with Dave, and really the end of my career, full stop. I was dropped by the record company, the management, everything. I was out on my ear, you know. So, well, that's what rock and roll's like, isn't it? You know, 1 minute you're flavour of the month, next minute you haven't got a pot to piss in, and you're walking the streets with your guitar under your arm thinking, what am I going to do now, you know?
Yeah, that hasn't changed, has it?
No, it hasn't. I mean, it was the same when I left Motörhead. I remember walking along I'd left the Motörhead house in, because we all lived in a house in Clapham, and I've got my guitar under my arm, I've got a bottle of vodka in my pocket, and I'm walking down the street thinking, well, where am I going to f***ing go then?
We may as well get properly onto the subject of Motörhead. I mean, that's the classic Motörhead lineup from the beginning to Iron Fist. That was you, and they're celebrating 35 years nearly, and the influence that band still has on the industry. You must be immensely proud of that.
Oh, I am. Well, the best years of my life, and as you say, I mean, if I had had a choice of what was going to happen to me in my life as a guitar player, you know, when I was 12 years old playing guitar in my front room, to have a song like Ace of Spades and an accolade like Motörhead, one of the, you know, they really, you know, it really stands alone, Motörhead. And I saw Lemmy's movie the other day. I did an interview for it. I don't know if you've seen it, Lemmy, the movie. But I watched him at the end walking away, and I thought, Lem, you must be so proud. You've actually achieved all you ever wanted to achieve.
Well, yeah, and it's funny because I think Lem said it, and it sounds like you'd agree with the same thing. Everybody seems to ask Biff and Lemmy and you guys all the same question. Oh, when are you going to, you know, when are you going to retire? When are you going to stop? And I think Lemmy said, hang on a minute. If you got the chance to do what you always wanted to do, why would you stop?
Absolutely. There's absolutely no reason for it whatsoever, you know. I mean, even if you... The nice thing that's happened, actually, in the last sort of 20 years, which I think is good for us, is the fact that people seem to accept that, you know, the old people want to go on and keep playing and rocking on. And there's a small audience out there that keeps showing up that make it kind of respectable, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was a kid, I remember, well, when I was like in my 20s, in like 19, late 60s and 70s, you know, when you got to this age, you were history, you know. I mean, you couldn't possibly carry on.
Yeah.
But now it's possible because, well, you know, with modern technology and all that, you can still look pretty good. Hang on, I'll just adjust my hairstyle, my wig, you know.
Well, I mean, it's not just that. Of course, what everybody talks about now is when you look at the bands that are still playing or the ones that we listened to back then, in terms of, you know, headliners and people that could force you to immediately stick your hand in your pocket and buy a ticket, that new generation ain't quite cutting the mustard as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I'll tell you what, though. I mean, I saw Kasabian the other night on Oh, Jules Holland. Well, what a fucking... I mean, mate, they really need to... They had this slow song going on. Deep, meaningful song. They had a fucking... They had four or five cello players there, you know what I mean? And I'm thinking, this is supposed to be a fucking rock band, isn't it? Well, you do. You think, well, hang on, who are they kidding? And they were trying to look so fucking... It reminds me of fucking... Who was it who had Every Rose Has Its Thorn?
That would be Poison.
Oh, fuck's sake. Yeah, you know, then you get all these guys, they dress up like fucking monsters, you know. And then they go and do a song like Every Rose Has a Thorn, you know. And I think, well, did you really need to do that?
What track are we going to play off the album, by the way?
Let me have a quick look. Sick as a Dog.
If you fancy a night out this month and next, there's plenty to see. Old friends of the show, Tokyo Blade, who recently released the first of three charity singles, are playing in their hometown of Salisbury on Friday the 24th of August, followed by The Borderline in London on Saturday the 25th, supported by Deep Machine. As always, it'll be a party night, so get yourselves down there for that one. Kill Devil Hill, which features drummer Vinny Appice, who we have on the show next month, are touring the US at the moment, as are Legends Kansas in September and October. Also out on the road in the UK this September are The Cult, Marillion, Gunn, Patti Smith, Wasp, Pat Travers and Ray Davis. UFO are still doing their thing, of course, and this year saw Seven Deadly, the latest in a long line of studio albums, released through the mighty SPV label. Vinnie Moore has been handling guitar duties since 2004, and 2009's The Visitor album saw the band return to the UK charts for the first time in 15 years. Long-standing keyboard and rhythm guitarist Paul Raymond was kind enough to come on and reminisce, but we started with the why keyboards are never high enough in the final mix conundrum. Time to point the finger at producer Tommy Newton.
Yes, dear Tommy Newton, I have a bit of a thing with another keyboards, you know, he never seems to turn them up loud enough, but an issue. I've got an issue with that man.
I think that's a general production issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
I remember in an interview back at the Hard Rock Hell show back in 2010, which I'm sure you remember for various reasons. I think you...
was that the one Batman?
Yeah, that's the one. But I think you'd said at the time, I seem to remember, it was hard to do something new these days. And it sort of not preyed on my mind, but I was thinking about it, because obviously, for me, as a fan, it's kind of okay, because I just kind of want more of the same UFO. I don't necessarily want something new. Having said that, the new album does sound... It doesn't sound old in any way. It sounds... Do you know what I mean?
No, I know, but, you know... Do you remember Dave Dixon, the writer for Kerrang?
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you remember Dave? Dave said something to me that always stuck in my mind, and he said, really, basically, all the best songs have already been written. Right. The rest, and now, from now onwards, in fact, since years ago, it's just endless repetition. And it's a bit cruel, but I tend to agree with it. It is, you know, I can't come up with anything that I don't go, mind you, I've been in the business for so long now, but I don't go, this reminds me of something, you know, like, This is like so-and-so. Well, the worst one was George Harrison, when he actually got into terrible trouble over the My Sweet Lord thing, which was actually the Chiffons' He's So Fine, yeah. And he didn't realise it, you know, and he had to pay all that money. So, yes, it's very much that way. It's difficult to come up with that, something completely new. See, like, new bands, I like Muse. They're kind of different, but, you know, there's a lot of Queen in there. I'm feeling, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. But then again, I think the Muse Fish and Chips has been around a long time, but if a new one opens down the road and they do it a little bit different, I'm going to jump in there, you know?
That's a really great way of explaining. I should remember that, yeah.
So I guess I'm
explaining. Next time somebody criticises one song that I've taken in, I usually go, oh, well, I only steal from the best, you know.
Well, there you go, you can have that one.
Yeah.
Talking of repetition, I guess, the UFO live set is usually, you know, a few new numbers and as much of the classics as you can possibly squeeze in. I mean, is there a favourite in there for you that you still look forward to playing more than the others?
We still play I'm a Loser. This is a song that I wasn't involved in, but I think this is a classic UFO song. It's got all the ingredients. I think that's Michael at the top of his game, you know. The way it got the chord sequence unravels, it's, yeah, this is a classic for me. Love to Love, could never leave that one out, you know. And Try Me is back in the set now, and that's another classic.
Yeah, absolutely. Lights Out was your first UFO album, wasn't it?
That's correct, yeah.
And I think there were some classic songs you wrote early on but weren't credited for. Why was that?
That's right. Well, I had a bad publishing deal with Savoy Brown people. Anything you hear the piano on, you know it's me.
Yeah, that's a dead giveaway, isn't it?
So people have said to me, like, looking out for number one on Obsession, you know, I could never get my head around Pete Way playing the piano, you know, like, and working all that out. Anyway.
UFO have been... It sounds like a silly understatement, but, I mean, hugely influential on a number of bands who've gone on to be... amongst the biggest ever, like Iron Maiden and Metallica, just a couple. I mean, how does it feel to be partly responsible for such a phenomenon? Do you even think about it much?
Ooh, how does it feel to be a rock legend, Oliver?
That's the one, yeah. I rephrased it, but that's it, basically.
Like that these days. I think if you stay in the business long enough, you know, they're going to start saying that to you. I always go, I'm not Jimmy Page or Pete Townsend, do me a favour, you know, but it is nice. The younger bands, well, they're not so young either now, are they?
No.
Maiden, and it's nice to have, you know, done something that was really recognised. Those early records from the mid-70s till Michael left, I thought were pretty classic.
UFO has had various incidents over the years, and I just wondered, what were your UFO high and low points?
High points would be Strange in the Night era, you know, that's we were pretty high flying then. And low points, just before I rejoined for the misdemeanor thing.
Right.
I was living in Los Angeles and doing a lot of drugs, and, you know, fortunately I got myself out of that, but yeah, that's the low point.
Right.
84, 83.
Right.
Oh, no, actually, I was in Wasted, wasn't I, in 83?
Indeed.
So it must have been before that, 82. It's all a long time ago now.
It's all a blur, isn't it?
Yeah. In the mists of time, yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, I ask purely because of the close connection between the two bands, but you're touring again this year with another new album, but what do you think of the Scorpions' decision to call it a day?
Yeah, I was a bit shocked by that.
Hmm.
Actually, maybe they've got enough money. You can never have enough money, can you?
A lot of bands can't seem to string together a bunch of dates these days. It must be tremendously gratifying that people still want to come out and see UFO every year.
Yeah, we don't normally do more than 3 or 4 weeks on a run. You know, we try and make it easy on ourselves now. Strokes long white beard, you know. you know, 3 or 4 weeks. And also for Phil to really sing it every night, you know, I guess, if he has to do 5 in a row. But it's the same for all of them, you know, Ozzy's like that as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just getting old and you can't do it anymore. But
have you got a favourite place to play in the world?
In the world? Oh, Brazil. They go absolutely crazy there.
Right.
America's always, you know, America's always great.
Yeah.
And before I went to Brazil, I would have said the States, but Brazil, they seem to be a little bit starved of it down there, you know, and they really make a fuss of you.
Yeah.
And there's always plenty of young ladies as well, which is always quite nice, you know.
Don't wear a lot, do they, either? Shocking.
No. Can we change the subjects? Bad for me. No pacemaking.
Well, yeah, I think what it was, obviously, there was Rock in Rio was the only show in town for a long, long time. And then, because you just couldn't tour there, I don't think, generally speaking to bands, it was unreliable. You couldn't get paid and you didn't know whether you were going to get ripped off. So people didn't go. But now it's a lot more sorted. So bands are going. And the fans have been waiting, you know, people my age, 40s, have been waiting almost that long to see some of you guys. So
yeah.
They can't wait that straight out.
Well, our first trip there was 2010, you know.
Really?
The promoters was delighted.
Wow.
And I think there's twice as many dates this time.
Wow.
It's kind of tough. You don't have a tour bus there. You know, you have to use commercial airlines, and that gets it's really hard getting up and getting on those planes. You know, and there were late gigs as well, so it was kind of tough. But the people made it worthwhile, I have to say. Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, the guys, they're just like a football match or something, you know. Absolutely crazy.
That's what you want. Well, we're going to play something off Seven Deadly, and it's my show, so I get to shortlist the tracks that we might play, but you can choose the actual one. So I've got it down to 3, and you need to pick one. It's either Fight Night, Mojo Town, or Waving Goodbye. Any preference?
Do you know, Fight Night is my song. It's Phil's lyrics, but it's my music.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go for Waving Goodbye because I can hear the organ really good on that, and I like that song anyway.
Good.
But that's the one I go for.
Perfect. Well, we'll have that. And so long as it's not Waving Goodbye to UFO, I'll play it. That's the deal I'm going to make with you.
Okay. No, not yet, Oliver. There's still life in us yet.
Talk about your solution. Talk about problems. You talk about yourself a lot. Put another coin in the slot to your master plan. I hear your music praying. I see your madmen praying. Whilst your tantrum's raising, all that crying around, crying around, yeah. Waving goodbye in the last chance saloon. I'm waving goodbye. I'm in Rick's recovery room. Talked about intensity, forgot about sensibility. That's you and me, babe. Talked about your love life burning. It was quite stomach turning to those who knew you best. Talk about your music playing. All I see is madmen praying. Whilst you have a tantrum railing, your soul's not for saving, a spotlight craving into the wilderness. I'm waving goodbye in the last chance saloon. Oh yeah.
Just time for some new releases then, and some catching up to do. Accept had Stalingrad, the follow-up to the amazingly successful Blood of Nations album. Europe followed up Last Look at Eden with the equally brilliant Bag of Bones. Saxon have a double DVD and DVD package chronicling their live shows at the Wacken Festival in Germany, which is Heavy Metal Thunder, Eagles Over Wacken. Universal re-released a bunch of Thin Lizzy and Black Sabbath albums under the Classic Album label, and Asia followed up 2010's Amiga with XXX, again released through Frontiers. Gunn had Break the Silence out, and Ozzy released a very welcome DVD from the Speak of the Devil tour back in 1982, following the death of Randy Rhoads, that lineup of course featuring Brad Gillis from Night Ranger. Well, that's all from us this time. I hope you enjoyed the show. Please remember that the show is partly to remind everyone how great these bands are and to make you aware that very few are living in the lap of luxury. So please, please, if you hear something you like, go and buy something from that artist, an album, a shirt, or just a track from iTunes or wherever. You'll find links in the show notes. It all helps oil the wheels because people do still have to eat, you know. Finally, I would also like to point you to our website at classicrockpodcast.com, where you can find all the old shows and band information, plus a new addition, the ability to throw some change our way if you appreciate all our efforts in bringing these shows to you. We don't receive any funding for doing them, and we also have to eat, so all contributions will be greatly received. Have a good one. Catch you next time.